Taking that work break. Join us for our weekly speed run through the week's IT news. We're going to talk about a new GPU from Intel, a security acquisition by Zscaler that aims to do away with NAC, continuing U.S. investment in chip manufacturing, and more tech news. We're sponsored today by G-Core. G-Core has introduced FastEdge, a new product in low-latency edge computing for serverless app deployment built on WebAssembly. With FastEdge, your code runs closer to your users than ever before, leveraging a global CDN network of over 160 data centers to ensure lightning-fast performance. You can join the FastEdge beta today and transform how your applications are delivered. Visit gcore.com/packetpushers to learn more. With FastEdge, the future of edge computing is here, and it's ready to power your next big idea. That's gcore.com/packetpushers. We've also got a Tech Bytes podcast with sponsor Fortinet, where we talk about the push and pull between point security solutions and platforms. We'll dig into how Fortinet designs its software and hardware to optimize its platform while building a fabric to incorporate the inevitable point products that arise. Right, before we get to the news, we've got some FU. First, Intel GPU and software drivers. Somebody wrote in, Greg, with a question for you about, I guess they have a, I'm not really sure what their point was.
We were talking about software and how important the software frameworks are in the context of AI. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about NVIDIA's CUDA frameworks, basically the CUDA frameworks. And he's saying that, you know, graphics drivers are hard and cards are often shipped, released with incomplete drivers. It's just that NVIDIA and AMD have a lot of experience with this, a large pile of money, yet test gear and relationships with GLAM devs to polish it a bit more for before a graphics card release. Still, a new GPU architecture is often pretty rough, even for those companies. GPU drivers are hard. Intel is playing catch up, but they continue to work at it. I'm not usually a Intel fanboy, but this is the most seriously they've taken graphics. I'll give them that. So he's making a point here is that vendors in the GPU space often ship incomplete and faulty products, is basically what he's saying. Uh-huh. And once it's out there in the public, they wait for customers to tell them what's wrong, and then they rapidly iterate on it and fix it in a period of time, which is time-honored tradition in technology. Now, the customers always take the hit. They expect to buy faulty products and they expect to live with them. So that's just the way it is. But I would also make the counterpoint that we are at least two decades into GPU development and GPU products, and they've been mature for several years. Realistically, that should not happen. The GPUs that we're now seeing as AI processors, or as they're now being renamed XPU. So we're seeing a trend where Intel and Broadcom are now calling them XPUs. When you create an AI processor, because it could be many different ways around. You could either have a GPU or a TPU or some other type of thing.
Sure.
XPU seems to be a convention that they're sort of converging on. But it's much more than just drivers. It's also about the software frameworks that bring developers to the platform. So, for example, PyTorch, a very popular machine learning library. Of course, machine learning is now just called AI because whatever. And Intel has shipped extensions, which must be installed to get the maximum performance for Gaudi 3. So you have to go and buy, get the Gaudi 3 extensions or the Gaudi 2 extensions, and then add them to your Python installation so that you can then get the accelerated processing, so the hardware accelerations in place. And, but if you go and have a look at, say, Intel support for Jupyter Notebooks, which is another machine learning engine, the support for that's not quite so great. Whereas if you go over to NVIDIA, NVIDIA has its CUDA platform. It has these comprehensive sets of libraries and significant resources. And you can just go over there and, like, for example, if you wanted to have a Python PyTorch ready, just here, install a Docker container. It's all ready to go. Click here, repositories ready, off you go. And that's the gap I'm seeing here, is that NVIDIA's a lot further down this path of how do we make this possible for the developers to absorb? What's the easiest way for them to start using our hardware? Give them a Docker container with all the modules, all the frameworks, all the software installed,
right,
and here's the command to install it. Bang, done, right?
Yes.
Now, that may not be where you want to be long-term, but if you're just starting to do some development and some evaluation, whereas in Intel's case, you have to go to a website, you have to sign up for this, you have to download this library, you have to know where to install it. So that's what I'm referring to here, is that sort of gap is opening up. And NVIDIA knows that its long-term leadership in the market is by having its software platform complementing its hardware. Sure, they can have the best hardware in the world, and we'll talk more about what's changing there, but I think that NVIDIA is also realizing that its real domination of this market, the long-term control of the market, is the CUDA software platform, and the teams are doing it. And of course, Intel's been doing this for decades. Part of its domination of the x86 has been because they've been spending $1 billion a year writing code for Linux. Uh-huh. You know, they have so many developers contributing to Linux that run on x86 that Linux is kind of de facto runs on x86. But that's the result of $1 billion a year of continuous effort by Intel. NVIDIA is applying the same approximate, you know, logic to AI and the software frameworks that you need to run to do AI.
All right, links in the show notes. We'll move on to one more FU. A listener wrote in asking, can you please explain, maybe a network break, what is the FISA debate that affects non-US people when using telecom or hosting service of a US company outside the US? Since it is quite hard legally and politically to debate this, it's not easy to follow and understanding for non-native English speaking people.
All right, so this is complicated. I'm going to avoid the whole political debate here. I'm just trying to dump out some information. So FISA is a US federal law that allows secret services such as the NSA to use electronic surveillance on foreign nationals anywhere in the world without oversight. What that means is no judge has to approve a wiretap or whatever. The secret services can say non-US citizens are less than whatever. They don't have any rights as far as the US is concerned. So we can just wiretap them at will. Same sort of thing exists, like the US refuses to extradite its citizens under certain circumstances and refuses to acknowledge international law in substantial parts. It's sort of a reflection of that entire policy of the US government type thing, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the Snowden revelations, all that Edward Snowden stuff exposed just how widespread and how indiscriminate this surveillance was, and that it included American citizens. So, for example, when you're collecting every single international phone call on a particular line, you're probably recording one US citizen and one non-US citizen, right? But the FISA only enables, or there is a federal law that says you cannot spy on US citizens without a judge being involved in the process in the first place, right?
Right.
So the FISA is a piece of federal government terms that sets the terms and conditions on what surveillance can be performed if US citizens are involved, so on and so forth. Now, the thing about this FISA bill is it expires every so often so it can be reviewed. And the Republican Party has made changes. It's set to approve it. You know, it's been something that's been developed for a while. And then the presidential candidate, Mr. Trump, expressed some concerns about it. Punditry that I've seen around that is that FISA may have been part of the process for locating various evidence on the legal cases that Mr. Trump is facing. And he's decided that if he holds up this FISA, then he might be able to improve the legal cases that he's facing. He's facing rather a lot of them.
Yes.
And he also wants to deny his opponents ahead of the election. So he wants to deny the Democrat Party the ability to say, we got this legislation through. He doesn't want them to be able to campaign on that. And there is some evidence to suggest that he wants them to put that legislation back in play and then claim credit for passing that legislation through Parliament. But that's much more of a secondary issue. Right now, his short-term goals are to put a case together to get it. So as an outsider, the things that you need to know is the US doesn't do surveillance on its citizens, but it does surveillance on anybody who is a non-US citizen. There's no need for a judge to be involved. The US government also has the right to activate American companies as extensions of its surveillance operations. So if the US government goes to Cisco and demands to get access to captured data in the same way that we talk about China doing it, the US government can do the same thing.
Yes.
That's all part of FISA. There are some rules there. Sometimes they have to go for permission. They have to go to a judge to get an authorization for some of that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's a special FISA court for those kind of requests that might involve US citizens or US companies.
Yeah, but as an outsider, none of this makes sense. It doesn't appear to be good government because, you know, I live in the UK. If the UK government started to do the same thing to US citizens, the howling noises would be significant. So there is an inequality there that is not yet matched up with the reality. So, you know, US sets up and says the federal government won't interfere in the lives of its citizens, but anybody who is not a US citizen, it absolutely will. And that is not necessarily a long-term sustainable strategy, I suspect. I hope that makes sense.
Yes. I could say more, but I think we should just leave it there. But yeah, I think that was a decent summary. But let's dive into some news. We mentioned GPUs earlier. We're going to be talking about Intel. They've announced the next generation of its GPU, or I guess they would say an XPU, as they seek to push back against NVIDIA's AI dominance. Intel claims that its Gaudi 3 silicon is 50% faster than NVIDIA's H100 in timed training and is dramatically more power efficient. You should note that all of these claims are tied to specific models and parameters, and that the press release making these claims comes with footnotes. Gaudi 3 is expected to be available to OEMs, including Dell, HPE and others, in the second quarter of 2024.
Yeah, so there's obviously the thing here is that there's a lot of market for AI silicon. Customers want it. And while NVIDIA is leading the market now, I would say that there's still plenty of room for a second and third vendors like Intel and AMD. Of course, Meta and Google have their own XPU silicon. I suspect for them, this means buying less NVIDIA and Intel rather than no NVIDIA and Intel. Mm-hmm. Again, it comes back to software libraries, right?
Right.
If you're on Google and you're willing to use Google's AI libraries, then they'll run it on their own XPUs. If you're trying to run NVIDIA CUDA, you'll need to have an NVIDIA H100 or a Blackwell H200. And so you'll run it on that. If you're going to run Intel Gaudi, and that's what you want. So what we'll see is the off-prem clouds having all the possible AI silicon so that you can run whatever it is that you want to have. And you can have an argument about which one is gooder or better or something than the others. And that's basically what we're talking about here. Intel's Gaudi 3 is twice as good as the legacy H100. But if I remember rightly, we talked about NVIDIA 2 3 weeks ago, and I think they were saying the H200 is four times better than the H100. So
yeah, that's the thing. The claims that Intel are making are it's compared to NVIDIA's current H100. But yes, just a few weeks ago, NVIDIA announced the next-gen GPU, the Blackwell B200. So Intel is still, I guess, a generation behind here.
Obviously, they're moving at a different pace. NVIDIA's got the first to market, and Intel certainly needs to move as quickly as possible. And I think this is the obvious step. Intel's got GPU technology. It's got the chops to be able to make this work. It knows how to build software. So it absolutely should compete in this market.
For sure.
And then it's going to be an evolution. One thing, though, is where NVIDIA talked about networking for three or four slides in its keynote presentation, Intel put up one slide and just said Ethernet.
I mean, frankly, I was happy to see that Ethernet got a mention in there. Yeah, I think that's good.
Basically just said, someone else is going to do Ultra Ethernet, and that's good enough for us.
Right.
They're
all in on Ethernet, essentially. It'll be their mechanism for connecting accelerators, which I think is fine. It's a nice, clear message that we're backing Ethernet, and there's lots of other people who want to back Ethernet, and we're with them.
Sure, we can strap another rocket on that go-kart, all you like. And it'll probably even work with sufficient rockets, you know, and very large brakes. Obviously, Intel doesn't have an Ethernet ASIC, so it's got no dog in that hunt. And what's clear is, for now, it doesn't want to put a dog in that hunt. I would point out that PCIe is an Intel networking technology, and of course, it's one that Intel controls and owns for networking inside the server. So NVIDIA uses both PCI, but also NVLink. And they took a couple of shots at NVLink and said, shouldn't have to use a proprietary bus to get things done. And I thought, oh, that's a bit of a, okay, fine. But Intel does remain focused on NICs, smart NICs and DPUs. It's not clear what the DPU strategy looks like at Intel at the moment to me. But I would remind you that a 48-port switch needs 48 NICs or 48 smart NICs. Which side of that equation do you want to be on? And I think Intel's saying, we're just going to take the NICs. Thanks very much. We'll probably end up making more money out of those than we would out of making silicon. And we'll leave that market to Marvell and Broadcom et al. And Cisco too, of course, with their custom silicon. So yeah.
They did mention something about an Intel AI NIC. I didn't see any link, so I haven't chased that down. But we may want to look into that further.
They didn't make a big deal about it, networking at all, because they just swerved the whole thing.
I mean, you can understand that the message they want to come out is, NVIDIA is not the only player in the game. Intel, an old brand you know and love, is here, and we're ready to compete.
Well, they did pitch a vision of there's three markets for AI, is their vision. And one is the AI PC node, so in the desktop, the laptop or whatever, which is what we've seen Apple do. Apple puts a augmented reality chip in every one of its M1, M2, M3s. And the suggestion is that we'll now see a more fully fledged AI processor in there in future versions. But Intel's saying, you know, we give you that as part of our Intel Xeon, so there's the AI PC node. And then, of course, there's the superclusters or the mega clusters, and that's what the off-prem clouds are going to do. Like there's a bunch of dedicated cloud companies. So companies like G-Core, who's today's sponsor, they are running WebAssembly, accelerated WebAssembly in a software platform. But they could turn into AI companies and run the AI right at the edge of the network, potentially, right?
Right.
But the one that really interested me, of course, is the enterprise edge. And they're saying, like, we're going to be able to give you nodes and clusters, you know, you're looking at 3 to 5 racks worth of AI equipment for an enterprise type of thing. And it just strikes me that, you know, how many companies will just buy Intel servers with Gaudi just because it's easier than attempting to deal with NVIDIA? You know, NVIDIA's got supply constraints. They're heavily priced. It means you've got to run on ARM CPUs. Massive change, massive reskilling. Maybe it's just a lot easier to go and buy your Intel AI from, you know, your preferred brand vendor, you know, Cisco, HP, Dell.
Yeah.
So, you know, Intel's going to be quite successful about this in time, I feel.
I think Intel also needed just to have some positive news coming up, because the last few times we've been covering Intel, things have looked kind of grim. So for them to be able to be active and talking about advancements in a very hot market, which is AI, I think is something they needed. I'll also note that they made the announcement at an event in Phoenix, Arizona. Typically, these kind of major product launches will happen in Las Vegas or somewhere in the San Francisco Bay Area. My guess is that location is a nod to Intel's promise to build new chip plants in Arizona. So a little bit of savvy political theater by holding the event in Phoenix.
Maybe it's because TSMC is building chipsets Fabs in Arizona.
Yes, Arizona's coming up again later in the show, but who knew all roads pointed to Arizona for our AI future?
I wonder if that's a part of that decision process, right?
Could be.
Get some time with the politicians, get to be seen, you know.
And Phoenix was very deliberate, I think, as a location for this, for sure.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. Zscaler, they provide cloud-delivered security services, or SASE. They're acquiring a startup called AirGap Networks. AirGap Networks offers technology to prevent lateral movement by devices on campus or branch networks, including IoT and OT devices where you can't install agents. So when a device connects to the network, AirGap uses DHCP to assign them a /32 and then serves as a default gateway for the device. It then continually controls access based on device identity and context. Zscaler's touting this as a replacement for NAC and for internal firewalls deployed to manage east-west traffic.
So, I mean, one of the problems with Zscaler has been they just don't have any hardware, right? And so all of the solutions that use their cloud service either have to be somebody else's products. You go to some other SD-WAN SASE provider and you do a diversion into Zscaler, or you use stuff on the desktop to divert all the traffic flows into their cloud system.
I believe have SD-WAN and an agent at this point to get them that SASE designation. So, but yes, that's it for their presence in essentially for enterprise hardware or enterprise footprint, I should say.
Yeah, because I remember talking to executives from the company a while back. And they were like, oh, no, it's just software. We don't need hardware.
Right.
Nobody wants to do hardware. Nobody wants to have, and I'm looking at them going like, you don't want to do hardware. You don't want to have a stock of parts. You don't want to have to do support.
Right.
You don't want to have to build. And at that time, SD-WAN and SASE, you know, the companies who had gone around and built the hardware and built the devices and were doing the networking wanted to add the application inspection and so forth. And it was always obvious that at the end of the day, those companies could copy, you know, build a Zscaler competitor, as
totally.
We've seen.
And they have.
Alto, Fortinet, and that means the Zscaler is being increasingly cut off from customers, right? If you're going to have a firewall that has everything that Zscaler got from Fortinet or Palo Alto, or maybe even Cisco, arguably, then all of a sudden you've got a situation where what's the point of Zscaler, right? And
you've
got low cost. So at some point they had to buy a hardware company, many of them, and start to compete. And I think the competition here isn't, you know, like a Ruber. I believe the Zscaler is trying to position themselves against Palo Alto or Fortinet because those companies have such huge markups based on, you know, 50x multiples because of security, right? And that's where Zscaler wants to be. It wants to get that back because it lost it quite recently when the share price bounced around a bit. So, yeah.
Yeah, so it's interesting that this AirGap Networks and Zscaler want to, I think, sort of walk the line between having hardware and being a cloud-based company because they emphasize the fact that AirGap Networks is essentially a SaaS and primarily SaaS delivered, but there is an on-prem component. You do need some kind of hardware appliance or a virtual appliance to operate this, but they sort of like, in all the material I read, kind of paper that over like, it's a SaaSy, it's really a SaaS, it's really SaaS, because they want to emphasize that cloud element. Although this is very much a LAN solution, so you do need a presence on the campus. And so now they have it. And I think, yes, other SASE competitors obviously have LAN security products. So now Zscaler can start moving into their territory. And I think they're doing it very boldly by saying, you know, take away your NAC, take away your internal firewalls and use this instead. That is a very, I think, bold proposition.
Yeah. Tough ask because
just
companies like Fortinet, Fortinet and Palo Alto Networks have got a much more credible firewalling, you know, edge capability story than Zscaler does. And I think this is too late. They should have done this 3 to 5 years ago. 5 years ago wouldn't have been too early. 3 years ago would have been on time. This feels late to me.
It's too late because lateral movement is really difficult, the IoT space in particular. And I feel like this is primarily an IoT OT play, really. It sounds like they're trying to apply it to everything, but it really does feel like an IoT OT play. And that's a tricky space. So I don't feel like Zscaler is too late here. And they are wrapping the zero trust label hard around it. Everything is zero trust. So they're completely buzzword compliant with it as well. So
I've got this vision of people standing in a, you know, around going like, MPLS WAN, SD-WAN, SASE, SSE, Zero Trust, I win. You know, that stacking hands thing.
Yes. Yes. I'll see your SASE and raise you a Zero Trust.
That's right. And Zero Trust is trump cards at the moment.
Yes. Well, I'm sure Zero Trust will someday get replaced by Extreme Zero Trust or something. But
Ultra Trust.
Ultra. All right. But it also good to see, I think, Zscaler bringing some competition back to the LAN, to the incumbents that are there. So always happy to see more competition. Quick break to tell you about our sponsor, G-Core. They are introducing FastEdge. This is a new product in low-latency edge computing for serverless app deployment built on WebAssembly. With FastEdge, your code runs closer to your users than ever before. It leverages a global CDN network of more than 160 data centers to ensure lightning-fast performance. You can deploy your applications in minutes, code your preferred language, and enjoy a secure, serverless environment that scales automatically. It's simpler and faster than ever to build and deploy AI applications, image optimization services, and personalized web experiences. You can join the FastEdge beta today and transform how your applications are delivered. Visit gcore.com/packetpushers to learn more. With FastEdge, the future of edge computing is here, and it's ready to power your next big idea. Go to gcore.com/packetpushers. Back to the news. Just a note to observe that Juniper is celebrating the 5-year anniversary of its Mist acquisition.
I wouldn't call it a celebration. I think a brag would be a better description of the post, but fair enough. I mean, I continue to maintain the view that Mist is something that stands out against a background of fairly static and stagnant networking marketplace. And what it did remind me, and we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, about how long Juniper Mist has been around, and they're saying, well, it's our fifth anniversary at Juniper, but it was founded in 2014. So 5 and 10. Mist idea has been around for 10 years. Now, Mist was originally, if you remember back far enough and taking briefings, it was a machine learning or a deep learning product. Remember that? The first Mist briefing?
Yep. It was ML.
And now, of course, it's AI ops. So just, but they are a pioneer in the idea of AI ops and have achieved real success on that basis. And I look forward to seeing them, you know, continuing to get an edge over the incumbent vendors. It must be really annoying to Aruba and Cisco and, you know, for Juniper to have this technology and be so far ahead of them at this point. Well done to them.
Yeah, whatever you want to say about Mist, and we've had some conversations about with some feedback on, are we overhyping Mist? And yes, that we need to be careful of that, but it certainly revitalized Juniper's efforts to be a presence in the enterprise campus. You know, Juniper has sort of always had trouble deciding whether it was a routing company or a routing company plus an enterprise company. Mist firmly anchored them in being both. So it is a significant milestone for them. Mm. Moving on, we're going to talk a little bit about open source. There's some controversy about the open source Redis project recently changing its licensing because it felt that the open source code was being taken advantage of, in particular by huge and profitable cloud providers. After Redis made the license change, a fork was developed that's being supported by the Linux Foundation and Amazon and Google Cloud, among others. We'll also have some comments about OpenTofu and that ongoing split from Terraform, but let's deal with Redis first.
What I wanted to do here, Drew, was to draw a parallel between what's happening with Tofu, Terraform, and Redis and Valkey, right? So these are two open source projects that are being forked. And obviously, every time we talk about forking open source projects, people have lots of big feelings.
Big.
And this often leads to obscuring of what are the actual underlying issues. Let's talk a little bit about the Redis one, because it's interesting to compare it to the Terraform one, right? Mm-hmm. So the Redis database was forked in the last few weeks. And on one side, what you basically have is a bunch of major clouds, AWS, Google, Tencent, Huawei, and a few others. And another one, which is a company called Garantia, which later renamed itself to Redis, an Italian company, right? And Garantia has decided to change the name. You know, it sort of manages the current repositories for Redis, and it's decided to change the license of the version of the code that it develops and maintains from a BSD, you know, anybody, anywhere, anytime, mm-hmm. to a source available license. That is, you can't change it without their approval. You can't make money off it without them. The usual sort of thing that we've seen quite often, right?
Yes.
And so your instant reaction to that is like, oh, the mega clouds are attacking another yet open source project for their own profit. But when you start scratching away at this, Garantia Redis was an early commercial supporter of Redis, but they were never actually involved in writing Redis, if that makes sense, right?
Okay.
They didn't. So, you know, and back in 2015, the project founder joined the company, transferred naming rights to them before moving on 2020. So, like, if you found an open source project and then you register and take a trademark, then the founder of the open source project owns the rights to that brand name, right? Mm-hmm. And so he sold those to, or transferred those to Garantia, which renamed itself RedisDB, and now it's called. So, you know, does Garantia actually write all of the code? So you scratch away at a few more articles, and then you find out that no, the largest contributor to Redis today is Tencent, and then the Redis company at 20% of the code, and then it's Ali, Huawei, Amazon, ByteDance, NetEase. So actually, the largest contributors to Redis, according to, you know, GitHub and contributions and so forth from LWN, which is the Linux News Network, they're sort of saying that something like 60% or 70% of contributions towards Redis actually come from Chinese companies.
Uh-huh.
So make of what you will, right? So although Redis is a contributor, it only contributes about 20% of the total. So perhaps the lesson here is, you know, these people aren't the only custodian. They aren't responsible for growing Redis. They were just a company that set up to become a commercial provider for Redis very early, and they've managed to capture the market. But more importantly, they've managed to get a hold of the Redis name. So they're not like somebody who built Redis, created Redis, marketed Redis, supported Redis, and which is what actually happened with Terraform at HashiCorp, right? So the thing about Terraform and HashiCorp and the fork there to OpenTofu is that other companies were building tools around Terraform for profit without contributing as expected. So yes, they weren't even contributing, right? They were saying Terraform, open source, we can take it, bundle it up, add our tools on top, and then sell it as a wraparound, and Terraform disappears into the underlying sort of, you know, ether.
Right.
But in this case, HashiCorp has done everything, or nearly everything, right? They've created the product, they've developed the product, they maintain the product, they market their open source project, they build a business around it. It's a different thing, right? If you do anything to take up Terraform, you are genuinely taking the product away from the company that contributes the vast majority of code, sets the direction, sets the strategy. Whereas Redis has been very much a part of, you know, Amazon, Google, Tencent, Alibaba, and so forth. And they were the people who were often contributing more to it than the company called Redis. So if you want to talk about forking, there's a spectrum of nuance in there. Does that make sense?
I see what you're saying, because yes, my initial impression was Redis is being hard done by the giant clouds who are just, you know, sucking it up for their own advantage and not giving back to it. But that doesn't necessarily seem to be the case here.
Oh, no, they certainly are.
But they're also contributing to the code.
To some extent. It doesn't seem like Google, for example, is contributing much, or Amazon is contributing, you know, Amazon's from this here,
5%.
This analysis, they're saying 5%, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is probably a handful of employees contributing in their spare time. It's not like a commercial imperative to contribute, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in the case of Amazon, what they normally do is take an open source project and then work out how to scale it.
Yes.
They don't contribute the things that scale it back to the core. They just don't bother. I suspect that's more to do because they don't give their people time to do the contributions. Like they don't give them hours in a week to go and contribute that back to the main project. And that is work, right? It is work to contribute back and merge the changes on Git and then make the case to a committee and so forth and so on.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So in this case, the kerfuffle this week is around OpenTofu in the licensing thing. It looks as if somebody took some of the non-licensed code. Terraform is in a source available license. You can go and look at the source if that's what you want to do, but you can't take the source and copy it. And it looks as if someone injected code either capriciously or maliciously. And I'm not suggesting HashiCorp did this, by the way. I'm just saying what they did was took code out of the HashiCorp repository and dropped it into the OpenTofu, which is an advanced algorithm for improving the memory handling inside of Terraform, right? And so somebody looks like somebody went, I want that in there, stripped it, and then uploaded it. And now there's a court case pending. So so there's all this kerfuffle which brings them out. But I think the thing here is when open source projects fork, sometimes they're justifiable and sometimes they're not. And
yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's going to be very nuanced. I don't think you can get behind it and say, you know, one way or the other.
Yeah. I think the big takeaway is that, you know, for a long time, open source as a business model was kind of a tried and true mechanism to get your product into the hands of users, build a community around it, build enthusiasm around it, maybe get some contributions back to the code as well, and then build a business on top of it. It now seems in this environment that you may want to rethink that approach because of the fact that it's open source, that depending on the license, someone can take it and essentially do what they want with it because it's open source. And that may mean you're creating your own competitor, which I think HashiCorp was trying to head off at the pass, which is understandable. But then again, does that go against sort of the ethical idealism of open source? So we...
It absolutely does.
It
but
does.
It's also... All right, in the case of HashiCorp, it absolutely does. But it's also... that you could also make the case that, you know, that HashiCorp has done all of Terraform.
Yes.
And the associated things, right?
Right.
They marketed it. They got people to adopt it. They drove it. They got funding. They invested in it. They have developers. Most of the contributions come from HashiCorp. That is a world of difference from a company that started in early 2010s,
mm-hmm.
and set themselves up as a commercial Redis provider and just took over the project, right? And their contributions are probably less than a quarter.
Right. So, yes.
Yeah.
I also feel like there was a sort of moral cloak you could wrap yourself in by saying we're open source. And that moral cloak can get very weighty when suddenly business interests start to detract from those ideals. So, yeah, I guess,
well,
I just feel like
15 years ago, we were using open source as a way to get to market, like very cheap way to get to market.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It was a business decision, frankly. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
But cloaked in a sort of a moral stance. And so we need to divorce open source, I think, from that, you know, sort of idealism and moral high ground. At this point, if you're doing something open source in this environment, there are business repercussions that you need to very much be aware of.
And nowadays we don't see, startups with 50 million in funding releasing open source anymore.
Right. I mean, I think that was sort of what the VC community used to expect. Are you doing the open source to model because it had been so successful? But now that there are
There was a case. We were using open source to find product market fit.
Yep.
And it was thought that this was a way to really reduce costs because then you don't need sales and tech support and marketing. You can put out a version of the product and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And nowadays what they'll be doing is releasing it as source available, license, et cetera. So different times.
We're coming into different times, yeah. All right, a couple more services before we wrap. Chipmaker TSMC and the U.S. Department of Commerce have agreed to preliminary terms that would allocate as much as $6.6 billion in direct funding from the U.S. To TMC or to its subsidiary TSMC Arizona for new chip fabrication plants in the U.S. state of Arizona. TSMC has pledged to spend $65 billion for, quote, three greenfield leading-edge fabs in Phoenix, Arizona, which will manufacture the world's most advanced semiconductors, end quote.
Yeah, so we've been talking about this for a while and sort of pointing out the difficulties of building fabs, and there's been a wave of articles, of negative articles coming out saying the unions are upset with TSMC and the local councils aren't happy with what TSMC is doing, and the government has had problems with TSMC going too slow, or they were bringing in people from Taiwan to do skills, to do parts of the fab construction and all this sort of stuff, right? Uh-huh. And then all of a sudden this week it's light and joy. The US government's handing out a truckload of money, $6.6 billion.
Uh-huh.
And now all of a sudden it's like, and TSMC announces that it's now going to build a third plant. And not only that, but the whole construction project's ahead of schedule by several months. And everything's on track to be producing by 2025. Well, that's a huge turnaround, Dre, from what we were looking at, a year or two, over the last 12 months, which is all, oh, dear. So it really feels like they were going like, oh, if only you gave us the money, we'd be able to do better, right? And then all of a sudden.
Right. And
am I being too cynical? Yeah.
I think you're appropriately cynical. And in this case, maybe not cynical enough. We've been talking about this for multiple episodes now about sort of the chagrin about having to spend U.S. taxpayer dollars to build these fabrication plants because of decisions that were made in the past by these for-profit companies to leave the U.S. because it was very costly to build chips here and go find cheaper places to do it, and now to get federal money to come back. I guess it doesn't necessarily apply to TSMC because they weren't ever a U.S. company.
No.
But I frankly do think, as much as it calls me, it's great that if this actually works out and we do have a robust semiconductor manufacturing capability in the U.S., that is good for the economy. It is good geostrategically as well. So I guess I am sort of pro-investment.
Yeah. Now, a lot of these same sorts of things are happening in Europe, by the way.
Yes.
I'm only quoting, I can only find U.S. articles talking about these things. So I can only draw your attention to these articles. There is significant funding from various European governments, both the EU as a federal organization, and then each of the members of the EU has their own programs going on. So in the same way that the states are involved and the US federal government are involved, same thing's happening here in Europe on a similar sort of a basis. One thing that I did find, Drew, in one of the articles that, in the show notes, is that these fabs are actually very modern. They're not trailing edge.
So no, right.
The first fab is actually a 4-nanometer FinFET. The second fab will be producing 2-nanometer nanosheet process technology, and will also be able to now produce 3-nanometer technology chipsets. And the third fab will produce 2-nanometer or even better, depending on customer demand. So if they can go and find this 1-nanometer, I just still can't get over that. this is not a second rate fab or a trailing edge like a 20 or, 90 nanometer where a lot of chips, this is the full on best of the best type stuff. It's not there. Sometimes what TSMC does is they will ship obsolete gear to low-cost places like China is what they used to do, and then build chips in China using the old gear, right? And that was a very viable, you know, makes good business sense, or did make good business sense. But these are absolutely the most modern things. So good for Arizona. It'll be interesting to see how it works out. There's still plenty of issues, as the piece points out, you know, there's headcount and all this sort of thing. But hey, up to 6.6 billion, depending on what they deliver, is actually a lot of incentive for TSMC to get this done.
Yeah. I sort of wonder, I always felt like, so in the geopolitical sense, you know, Taiwan is vulnerable to disruption or even invasion from China. The U.S. is protecting Taiwan. And one of the reasons, I think, aside from the fact that Taiwan is a democracy, but TSMC was also a very good reason for the U.S. to have an interest or a stake in Taiwan's independence and freedom. If we get the advanced manufacturing capabilities onshore here, that is, you know, not great necessarily for Taiwan and its geopolitical issues. It becomes less the leverage that they have with the U.S. So I'm curious to see if these advanced capabilities actually make it here.
No, not really. Taiwan's building like a half a dozen of these. Mm-hmm. So whatever they're building in the U.S., they're building way more of them in Taiwan.
Well, that's right. What I mean. So, it's not that they wouldn't have it, but if Taiwan does get invaded, then that, you know, they could cut off access to the U.S.
Yeah. So we did talk about the earthquake in Taiwan and express some concern. I did follow up on that. Mm-hmm. It appears that the damage was minimal. There's certainly some disruption. The story that I've heard is that some of the shelves, the funes, as they call them, where the wafers are actually stored, some of them were disrupted and some wafers did fall out. So there was some damage to production. But the rest of the machinery are basically earthquake proof. That is, the actual production floors actually sit in suspended rooms inside those buildings on what amounts to springs or hydraulically damped containers, right? And they measure the distortion of those rooms in terms of nanometers during an earthquake. So on the whole, the reason we haven't seen any follow-up to that is because it didn't really have any substantial impact on operations. Certainly, my heart goes out to the people who were hurt and killed and the damage to civilian population. But in terms of chip manufacture, which is what we care about on this show, or what we talk about on this show, there's the impact is minor.
One question also back to all of this potential manufacturing capability happening in Arizona is, what about water? That's still an issue that I don't know that there's a good answer to.
I had one person write to me once and say they just recycle it. And I'm like, sure, but you need water to recycle water. I don't know. I'm still looking for that article, Drew, to convince me.
Yeah. So we will see. All right. A couple more stories before we wrap. Human talent is going to be required to operate all these chip making facilities in the U.S. and elsewhere. We know Taiwan actively recruits students from across Southeast Asia. I expect the U.S. will begin to do the same, but that will also probably result in some backlash.
So there's two articles here giving me a cross-section of the opinion. One is that TSMC is now recruiting people from the Malaysia and the Philippines. There's some cultural things going on here. Apparently, it's quite popular for Malaysian workers to come to Taiwan to work and then return to Malaysia. So they come away as like workers coming across and working in Taiwan, and then that's a common sort of path. Uh-huh. But in this case, TSMC is actively recruiting people out of universities in Malaysia and the Philippines because they're struggling to find enough workers who have chip and fabrication skills in Taiwan. Remember, I talked about this. So there's an article here about SK Hynix. They're building a chip packaging plant in Indiana. They're investing $3.86 billion to put this plant or to build this chip packaging plant in Indiana. And the takeaway that I wanted to give you in this context is SK Hynix intends to work in partnership with Purdue University and the Ivy Tech Community College to create training programs and multidisciplinary degree courses aimed at nurturing a skilled workforce and establishing a consistent stream of emerging talent for its advanced memory packaging facility and R&D operations. So this is, you know, you can build these plants, but they still need people.
Yes.
AI doesn't run the chip, doesn't, you know.
You can't just have an LLM make the chips. Come on.
Yeah. So I've got a bunch of, you know, there's a bunch of intersecting points here. You know, even Taiwan is struggling to produce enough graduates and people with skill. And in the US, they're actually building. Now, I do remember that in the CHIPS Act, there is a substantial amount of money. I believe it was up to $20 billion to being given out to universities to initiate the sort of programs that will produce the skilled graduates to work in these. But I haven't seen much talked about on that. Whether that's gone wrong or whether that's still out there, who knows? But there you go.
Yeah, I think these things, when you're moving billions of dollars into the economy, it takes a while for that process to happen. So, but we should keep an eye on that. Yeah, because human talent is also going to be a limiting factor here, potentially a limiting factor.
Well, more than water. You put water in a pipe.
I mean, you can make more, you can train more graduates to work in the industry. You can't make more water.
No. All right.
Last story, in a countervailing story about free government money, the Biden administration is looking to close a tax loophole that shields private space companies from having to pay a tax that supports federal air traffic controllers. The issue is that when a rocket launches, air traffic controllers have to close airspace around the launch. They have to coordinate with hundreds or perhaps thousands of flights to reroute them over a period of hours. That work comes with costs that private space companies haven't had to bear. The Biden administration is looking to change that.
Yeah, so the FAA is basically a user pay system. The airlines pay to have the FAA run the air traffic control network across the US. And you could have an argument around how modern and efficient and sustainable that is. But anyway, the point is that up until now, space launches have been getting, they don't have to pay.
Yeah.
They just tell the FAA, you know, ring up the air traffic control and that's whatever. And basically the tax is paid by commercial airlines, which is roughly $5 to $20 per passenger in the US, depending on the flight, you know, just all that sort of stuff. Is that's how it's paid for. And the space companies get a free ride, even though there's an enormous amount of work to be able to, you know, clear the airspace and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So they're just going to say, like, you have to pay something towards that, which, you know, in a good capitalist society, user pays. That should make sense, shouldn't it? Surely that's not controversial.
Well, it turns out an industry group representing private space companies says that this is not the appropriate time to tax this industry because it is so nascent. And so a tax could, you know, you don't want to kill the child in the crib, I guess, with this tax.
So my counter argument to that, Drew, is while they're small enough to be bullied, now is the time to put something in place.
Absolutely.
Because if they get much larger and turn into AWS and you can't, you know, Amazon, and you can't put control, you know, you can't close the gate after the horse is bolted, blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
It now is the time to do something. And what you do is you increase, you put it on, and you put on a modest charge at this point in time, you know.
Absolutely.
Charge them $250,000 per launch, you know, or $500,000 per launch, which is nothing out of an $18 billion total budget for the FAA, right?
Totally.
And then you just jack it up as needed, right? And in the future, you turn it up to $1 million per shot, you know, whatever.
So. Yeah. So just some numbers here from, this is an article from the New York Times. In 2023, the FAA oversaw 117 launches. 2024 is on track to surpass that number compared to a decade ago when they might just have to coordinate 15 or so launches. So we are seeing significant growth in the work that the FAA has to do. So it does seem fair that the private space companies should chip in for this, because obviously it's not going to serve them if a rocket collides with a plane, or a piece of you know, debris coming off a rocket hits a plane or something. That's not good for them anyway. So time to get the tax. And the other thing is, you and I talk about all the time that these companies tend to get a lot of government subsidies anyway. So essentially it's going to be them paying the government back with the government's own money anyway. So why not?
Yeah. And of course, the flip side of that is that once, you know, right now they complain that the FAA doesn't do what they want, right? Well, you're not paying them. You're getting it for free. So
it's true. Yes.
When you're paying for it, maybe you can whine maybe a bit louder and say, but I'm paying for this. You
exactly.
Know? Think of the moral superiority you'll feel once that happens. You know, think of.
Have you considered the moral superiority? Yes.
Oh, I love capitalism. So fantastic.
It's great. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that wraps up the news portion of the show. As always, links are in the show notes if you want to read up on it more. Please do stick around for our Tech Bytes conversation with Fortinet, where we're going to be talking about point products and platforms and security and how it all comes together. That's coming right up. The security product lifecycle goes something like this. A new point product emerges from the threat landscape to fill an ecological niche. Over time, that point product gets incorporated into a broader suite. It happens in network security over and over. The firewall gets a VPN, and then an IPS, and then anti-malware, and so on until you have a platform. Today's Tech Byte sponsor, Fortinet, has recognized this pattern and is here to make the case for its approach to platforms. That is how Fortinet designs its software and hardware to build an optimized platform. Can they make a good case? We talk with John Madison, Fortinet's chief marketing officer, and you can judge for yourself. So John, welcome to the podcast. Let's dive right in. How does Fortinet design its products to address this sort of push and pull between point products and platforms?
There's always a need, I think, for point products, especially in cybersecurity, since the threat landscape moves a lot and people are changing their infrastructure. So there'll always be point products, but some of those point products become commoditized or stable. And at that point, you can then put them into what I call a functional platform. Good examples are Next-Gen Firewall or Secure Services Edge, or even, you know, even SD-WAN and gateways. And so this process will continue. There is a kind of a thinking now that you can take that functional platform even further and make it a suite. Now, it's probably a bad name because not everything is software, but the suite would then take functional platforms and put them together. So, you know, examples we hear about are XDR, where you're taking SOC and endpoint together, or single vendor SASE, where you're taking SD-WAN platforms and bringing them with SSE platforms, or SD-Branch, where you're taking Wi-Fi switching, the CNAP in the cloud, multiple functions. But there's also, I think, I speak to some customers, especially some larger customers, who say, well, I need dual sourcing. They're kind of the anti-platform. I'm going to go, I'm going to have two of everything. So if anything goes wrong, I've got it all there. So I think...
It's the old security joke. If you want a protection from Israel, get a checkpoint. If you want protection from the US, get a Huawei firewall. You know, that sort of joke is to have multiple different brands.
Well, it's also compliance as well. So if they, you know, the other thing is a lot of people have implemented some SaaS security. Now, when your SaaS security goes down, you're at your desk and your exec staff are calling you going, when's it going to get fixed? And you're going, well, I'm waiting for an email or something to come through. I've got no control whatsoever. And so I need this resiliency almost inside.
I think what you're alluding to here is we've seen a bit of a messaging over the last 3 to 5 years of there's too many security products. I think somebody said there's like 200 categories of security products at one point. And I think it's convert, as you say, but a lot of those are commoditized. It's like firewalls now are commoditized. And then next generation firewalls came along and added more. And then on top of next generation firewalls, they've now become SD-WAN edge points. You know, we can now put next generation firewalls with SD-WAN into a branch, and now we can, you know, and then the security then stretched out into the branch network and into the campus. And I think what we're actually seeing here is a transition away from security as a firewall or security at the edge to many points of security to actually just the whole network is a security function. And so you've got to start treating it like a platform because the security needs to be in-depth, evenly spread, equally managed as one platform.
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, the fundamentals of Fortinet, the reason the company was started was this issue around networking. You know, networking was designed to trust everything, connect everything, and it's just got faster and faster over the last 20, 30 years. What we're saying is that trust nothing and check everything before you connect. And those connections can be anywhere, as you say, across the network today. And that's why next-gen firewalls came into place, where you're saying, let me connect, let me check the application first, let me check the content, who is the user? And that those principles then start to spread into SASE and Zero Trust, where you're checking the posture of the device. Eventually, you'll be checking a connection based on the context of that user driven by AI. And so think about those steps as you go through it. You're checking, you're doing more and more checks, more and more sophisticated checks for every connection you make. It just changed the dynamics of networking because it was always supposed to connect everything as fast as possible. I don't care what you're doing or who you are.
Yeah, we started off inspecting packets, then we started off inspecting flows, then we inspected applications, now we're inspecting users.
And the posture and the devices.
So let me ask you a question here. This idea of a platform is sometimes used by vendors to sort of get customers to buy more, saying buy our platform, but you have to buy all of this. But I think the reality for security is that different customers have different needs. Do I have to buy the entire platform? Is there some sort of flexibility in there to say, you know, I just want this part of the platform, or maybe I need to grow into it over the next 5 years on a budget cycle, spending or something?
Yeah, the most complaints I hear is when some large vendors sold the whole platform for this giant EA and enterprise agreement, and 3 years comes up, they've only used 20% of it, and they're still being charged for the entire thing, and people get upset, quite rightly. So as I said, I think people go on their own journey, and they should be able to use as much or as little of the platform as they require that makes sense, and they should only be charged for that. And I also think that it's never going to be one vendor. For a reasonable sized company, you're going to have at least 4 or 5 platforms in there. And so you need to work together, and the APIs need to work. And you can't just say, oh, I don't like those people. I'm not working with them. that's not going to work.
So it sounds like you're taking a realistic approach. You're recognizing that the real world is people start somewhere and finish somewhere else. And sometimes that's got multiple parties involved. And sometimes that's starting here, but growing steadily over time as the money's available or as the skills build up.
Yeah, exactly. They go on a journey. There's a typical journey for us, which usually consists of firewalling, then I switch on the SD-WAN, then I control APs and switches, then I'll turn on remote access, then a bit of... So everyone has a... It's usually the same, but they can stop and start at different places.
So one of the things we're talking about here with the platform is that a security company or a networking company could basically acquire a bunch of point products and, you know, put some marketing slides around and say, we have a platform, but Fortinet's approach has been different intentionally, yes?
Yeah, and the other complaint I get is, and we get asked this a lot, you know, are you going to be acquired or are you acquiring? Because one of the worst situations is they make the decision around a specific product, it gets acquired, the company sticks their badge on it and says, oh, it's now a platform. Now, the trouble is with that is that when you buy a more mature product, it's got different types of code, it's got different APIs, management consoles. It is extremely hard to integrate and make it look like one platform. And that's why, you know, we've been using our operating system, FortiOS, to build our firewalls, same for SD-WAN, same for Wi-Fi switching, same for a single vendor SASE, same for SSE. So it doesn't matter where it is. Is it an appliance? Is it in our cloud? Is it in somebody else's cloud? Is it a virtual machine? It's the same OS. Now, even ourselves doing it that way, we still need to make sure the management consoles are synced up across that. It's extremely hard. I can't imagine trying to do it by acquiring completely different companies on different software standards and everything else. And one thing that I think I talk about with customers is that one evidence, one proof point for us is our magic quadrants. I don't know, some people hate magic quadrants. Some people love them. Most people are in the middle. Most people look the whole magic quadrant. They don't look at the leaders. But, you know, we're in right now four magic quadrants, a firewall, SD-WAN, single vendor SASE, and most recently we became a leader in wireless NAN LAN. It's the same product. It's the same operating system. And for most companies, it's either different companies or acquired products. That's really hard to do.
Does FortiOS run on the Forti phone? So you actually have IP phones. You actually sell IP telephony systems. This is something we've never talked about here. Does FortiOS actually run on the Forti phone?
Well, I talk about two platforms. One is our core platform, which is the operating system, FortiOS, which runs about 30 applications. I just mentioned a few of them. And then we have our fabric, where other products connect in through our fabric connectors. You know, we've done some acquisitions ourselves as well, like our EDR, but it runs on a separate, on a different, but it's connecting in. And eventually everything comes in. So for example, in the next year, our EDR, Forti EDR, you know, our sophisticated naming or system of Forti, whatever it does. Eventually Forti EDR will become part of our Forti client, which is very tightly linked into FortiOS. And think about convergence of the network. Think about convergence of the endpoint, where most companies have got 10 agents running around doing their own thing. Our Forti client now does EPP, VPN, EDR, SASE, Zero Trust, digital experience monitoring, all in a single agent.
And that agent is still FortiOS.
It's Forti client. It's Forti client, but it's very closely linked to FortiOS in that it can talk to FortiOS with a very special protocol. And for example, you know, the Zero Trust, you know, one of the most important things is in the middle of a connection or a session, does the posture change on the endpoint device? Well, change the Zero Trust policy ASAP.
I love that you aren't saying that you've got one pane of glass. What you're alluding to is a lot of people have, you know, that one management, one pane of glass, but really it looks more like a stained glass window. Lots of small panes of glass coming together to present a vision. But what
the biggest trick I see is people saying they use these virtual machines and they've got this 10 consoles on one each one's a virtual machine. I go, just cross the tabs here on my browser. It's a unified console.
But what I hear you saying is that you're converging as much as possible at whatever internal rate of change that you can achieve towards a single pane of glass, like less of a disparate, I bought 20 companies and I'm trying to weld them into a platform, more of a, you know, and they might have been using different versions of Linux underneath, they might have completely different code base, different languages. You're much more alluding to wherever practical, FortiOS is the core operating system, and that means it's much easier. Or
That's a good word. A good example was SD-WAN, where, you know, when SD-WAN came up, we thought it's going to be very important, and it is very important. We could have gone and bought something. We could have built it on a separate box much more quickly. But we built it straight in to the operating system, which was harder for us to do because you have other things going on inside there. So to me, our core stuff, like the wireless controller, like 5G, SD-WAN, is built inside there. And what we can also do over time is take some of our standalone product functionality like NAC or SIM or SOAR, which in a multi-vendor environment is essential because you've got to be able to connect to all these different people and you need sophisticated enterprise. We've taken some of those pieces like NAC and built it straight into the OS. So the seven most common use cases of NAC are now available on our OS, again, free of charge. You just switch them on. And from a lot of companies who are more Fortinet orientated, that works very well for them.
So you mentioned the security fabric. Is that just for other Fortinet products that aren't built on the FortiOS operating system, or does it include third-party products as well?
There's two levels. You know, the ones which are very close to FortiOS are the FortiClient, FortiManager, and the FortiAnalyzer, the analytics engine, which is becoming more and more important as the data lake and the ability to see things. So those products themselves are very tightly integrated. And then as you expand out, you've got, you know, our SIM, our SOAR, EDR, which are products which connect into the fabric, but not quite as close. But that functionality starts to be transferred across into the core FortiOS and those core products.
So what do you mean then by a fabric?
So fabric just means that we can exchange threat intelligence. We can exchange policies. We might use some of the most common data elements. It's kind of a lighter integration of some of these products that enables it to act like a fabric. It's not, as I say, to me, a platform, a core platform is something that's holistic in that everything's sitting on that platform and it can be managed by a single instance.
So what you're saying, let me try and extrapolate that. I've got a policy permit traffic to Microsoft Azure Office. If I implement that rule, then that can be equally implemented on the campus edge, on the SASE, on the NAC solution, or in the SSE. And I don't have to go around and do it individually in all of them. I can just say a global and make it a fabric change.
Yeah. And also, you know, if you want to run some sort of rule set, you know, again, that you could run it on those different management consoles and it all gets applied. Our thinking is that we're now entering this third era of network security, that we've gone through this first era, which was kind of firewalls, stateful firewalls, which was better than just connecting everything. You check ports, you check the IP, and went through this second era of next-gen firewalls, where you're now looking at applications and some content and some users. This third era of network security, we kind of refer to as unified SASE. There's some other names out there. But now, because of what you said at the beginning, now you've got edges everywhere that you now need to do that convergence across all the edges. And so you're taking SD-WAN and SSE and access points, and you're taking CASB, and you're having to kind of protect against all the different applications in the different locations. This third era of convergence also now expands from protecting the threats on the outside to protecting the data on the inside as well. So now you're looking at the data protection piece, which I don't think any vendors solved that well, this DLP. We're 20 years into it and people are still saying, oh, I'll see the answer.
You're making me laugh because I used to do a lot of DLP, and no, it's not a solved problem. And you know, I'm not 100% convinced at the current rate of change that it will ever be a solved problem. There's just too much. By the time DLP catches up with the state of the art has moved on in a funny sort of a way.
Well, I think AI may help a bit. Always the problem is, you know, is the data now spread even further. So the problem's only got worse.
Well, I think also it's the volume of it. And this is where ASICs, like your hardware leadership, like your ability to develop an ASIC. And then I think, again, it comes back to this one OS, FortiOS, and having your own ASIC just means you can almost, like, it's three ASICs really, but it almost means like, oh, I need to make my FortiOS go hardware. I can just add an ASIC to it. Is that kind of the idea?
Well, we call them ASICs here in this country, not ASICs, but that's okay. I'll let you slide.
Tomato, router, router.
Router. I think what happens is when you're providing, you're asking a lot more questions before you make the connection, you've got a lot more data to kind of sift through and apply. And you just, it's the same. My analogy, I think I always use, is the best, you know, gaming systems rendering are a CPU plus a GPU. It will always beat the highest end CPU. So the best security products are CPU plus SPU, security processing unit, which will always perform a lot better. And the other thing I'm starting to hear, especially from Europe, is the power efficiency. They're actually starting to test our systems now. You say you're 80% more power efficient, we're going to test it, and they do.
Yeah. You know, I was talking to someone the other day and they had a 25-year-old Switch, very famous, well-known Switch, and they worked out that they could buy a modern Switch and replace it and get ROI in 2 years just from saving power.
Yeah.
So you shouldn't be keeping those, you know, if you're into that level of testing and you've got that ability, it's actually fairly easy to do that. I think power is going to become a much bigger issue going forward. There's a shortage and it's going to be a bigger issue. And so the ASIC is a big deal. So you've got new stuff coming out. So at the back of this time, your conference is just coming up and you've got some news. What's the latest set of announcements? What sort of tell us where you're going next?
Yeah, so each year we do a big release of FortiOS, FortiOS 7.6. Maybe unlike even 5 years ago where we used to say, oh, these are all the features in our OS and they're on the appliance and away you go. When we do a release now, it sits across multiple areas. So our FortiOS release, for example, sits, you know, there's features inside there which will be available. There's the new SD-WAN, new firewall features that are available in the appliance, but it's also available in our SASE, FortiSASE console that's in our cloud. So, and it's also now connected into the FortiClient, which we've just announced integrating EDR inside there and digital experience monitoring. There's some new features inside the FortiAnalyzer, which is a part of that platform as well. And in fact, at our Accelerate last week, Accelerate 2024, we had about 4,000 partners and customers there. We demoed our new Gen AI in our FortiAnalyzer, where our head of product development started asking it questions and demoed a virtual SOC analyst asking it questions about why is that server slow? Why is that being attacked this way? And you can see where a lot of the AI, I know AI is so overhyped. We believe that the AI piece will be part of one of the most important areas will be the Gen AI sitting to make it more intuitive as a product, but actually acting as virtual analysts, both on the NOC side and the SOC side to help you find things more quickly and run more quickly. So again, a lot of features across many different things versus just one software blob and you just kind of announce the features inside there. When we do announcements these days of our operating system, it's actually across multiple products and multiple areas. A lot of emphasis on making sure we can add the new applications, the client, zero trust, new zero trust features, new SASE features, new analytics features as well.
All right, well, that does wrap up our time today. John, if folks are curious about Fortinet, about its platform, about FortiOS, about any of the capabilities or other products, where should they go?
Definitely fortinet.com.
Nice and easy, fortinet.com. We'll also have other links in the show notes for you to follow up on. Thank you, John, for joining us. And thanks to Fortinet for being a longtime sponsor of Packet Pushers. And as always, thank you for listening. You can find this and many more fine free technical podcasts and our Slack community. It's all at packetpushers.net. You can find us on LinkedIn, hear us on Spotify, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.